newcastlechurch.org. This is Christ the Center, episode 14, preliminary issues regarding the attributes of God. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation on Reformed theology. I am Camden Busey, and today I'm joined by the ever-present Jeff Waddington and Jim Cassidy, both from Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Hey, Camden.
And I just want you to know that we don't intend to ever share that attribute.
Those are incommunicable to you. As you are related to this program. But anyway, today, as you might guess from our bad jokes, we're going to be speaking about the attributes of God. We want to address first in this episode some preliminary issues related to God and his being, just who he is, some traditional distinctions that systematicians have made. But also in our next episode, we're going to discuss the actual incommunicable and communicable attributes, or however you, in your studies, distinguish those. Basically, between God as he is in himself and God as he relates to us. Before we begin, do we have any quick announcements? I know I was in the bookstore yesterday and happened across a new book. Did you guys pick this up, or do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's volume number 4 of Herman Bavinck's Reformed Dogmatics,
yes,
right?
I walked in, and a big semi just pulled up, and they were unloading 1,000 copies, and I grabbed one of them.
Nice. Did you pay for it?
I did. Okay. I want to mention that if you want to get that volume now from the Westminster Bookstore, they have it for 45% off, and it's a good one to have. It's got
That's a pretty good deal.
It's got a lot of notes at the end, bibliography, a lot of additional material in addition to the work on, I believe it's the Holy Spirit and the Church. So
that's right, and the end times. Yeah.
Yes,
and new creation.
That's right.
The title.
So that's a good one to pick up.
That brings the set to a conclusion.
Well, did they initially talk about putting the additional references in another volume, or and eventually just put them, tack them on to this fourth one?
I'm not aware of that. What is it? I don't have it. So what is it you're referring to, Kim?
Well, it's off on the bookshelf now, but just to spare some time, it has other materials, some scholarly references and resources in the back of the book that a little additional to what it doesn't exactly go with 4, but it pertains to the whole set, I believe.
Oh, okay, yeah, I was not privy to if they had made initial plans in one direction and then changed them.
But regardless, it's a good one to get, and if you get it now, you can get it at a good price. And Bavinck, I just really enjoy reading. He's a real solid guy, and we're blessed to have him in English now.
That's 912 pages. That's a pretty hefty volume.
Yeah, it's significantly larger than the other three.
Oh, it is. Okay, I was going to ask you if it was.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And that's 2749 at Westminster, mm-hmm. right? That's a good deal.
It is for how large it is, and it's a good. It's a good set to have. Looks nice, and it's sturdy. And it's going to last.
Yeah, of course, Bavinck is gigantic, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did How did J.I. Packer refer to him as the? Was it the Himalayas or I forget? The Everest. He's he referred to the Reformed Dogmatics as the Everest of textbooks. And he refers to Louis Burkhoff and Auguste Le Cerf as the foothills, and Burkhauer as the outlier.
Well,
so Bavinck, Packer compares Bavinck, or puts him in the same category with Augustine and Calvin and Edwards. So that's quite a, and I agree with that assessment. I think that's absolutely right on. Bob Bovink is phenomenal. Anybody who's read the other volumes should not be disappointed in this final volume. No. Now, some of this material had already been released as a paperback.
Was it the Our Reasonable Faith book?
No, well, it would be The Last Things.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
A few years ago, the eschatology section or the new creation section of the volume 4 had been released on its own. They had done In the Beginning and Last Things as to whet people's appetites.
Okay.
That was also a Baker publication.
Correct. It's the same set. I mean, it's the same translation.
Yeah.
I think they were just trying to get something out there to get people interested when the final full product became available.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Our Reasonable Faith those are selections from Reformed Dogmatics, correct?
No. It's a summary. It's not a quote. Bovink wrote it himself, but it's not merely quotations from the larger work. I think it's actually a summary. In many ways, much like Burkhoff, except that it's done by Bovink himself.
Sure.
Okay, so it was a separate volume that he published on his own.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And I wonder where we got the English title from, because the original was the Magnalia Dei, which is the great works of God.
Huh.
Or the great things of God, which is Latin. The original title has nothing to do with our reasonable faith.
Really? Maybe that's some publisher's idea somewhere.
Banner was the first one to publish that, right?
Or Baker, one of the two, I forget.
Oh, maybe Baker was first, and then Banner picked it up when it went out. Okay.
Yeah, so that may tell you more about the English context, right? Or the American context for that publication.
Yeah.
That the title was changed.
Exactly.
But anyway, this is an excellent volume. And in fact, in some way, our discussion today and for next week will be relying upon Bovink and Burkhoff to keep us on track.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. I would also recommend Richard Muller's third volume in his post-Reformation Church Dogmatics on the Divine Attributes. As we get into what we're talking about today, that volume is, at least the parts that I've read of it, have been very helpful to explain exactly what the issues are as theology develops within the post-Reformation period, and it becomes refined. What exactly the issues are going on, and why it is that we talk about these things and we start invoking language that sounds very technical and above our heads. Well, why is it important? Because there are certain issues, spiritual, of course, biblical, spiritual, Christian life issues that are at stake when we start talking about who God is and what is his nature. So this isn't some philosophical, pie-in-the-sky type of stuff.
Yeah, not this a stuff parlor was, game.
Right. This stuff was hashed out in the life of the church for important reasons, and those are things that come out very nicely in Muller's work. And, of course, his four volumes is worth to have on your shelf and to read through on its own merits.
Mm-hmm.
And the same would be the case with Scott Oliphant's Reasons for Faith, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He deals with the issue of the attributes of God, and we've talked about that in past episodes.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of God's attributes, we wanted to spend the time today speaking about some preliminary issues, and this, of course, is all bound up in the person and nature of God. In order for us to understand his attributes, we need to understand him. But at first, I think we must start with revelation, the fact that God is transcendent and that we can only know him because he has condescended. That's at the heart of this discussion, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, God has revealed himself to us. Otherwise, we would have no way of knowing who he is. The Westminster Confession puts it very nicely in this regard. It talks about the distance being so great between the creator and the creature. In fact, what you have are two different, the distance is such that you have two different sorts of beings altogether. Right. You have the creator and you have the creature. You have that which is God and that which is not God. And there's no overlapping essence or nature between the two. And that causes the great gap, the great distance between creator and creature. And if it weren't for God's revelation coming down to us, condescending, Calvin uses the word lisp. He whispers, he lisps, he speaks baby talk to us in language that we know and we can understand by virtue of his revelation, so that we as creatures, weak and frail, are able to know and understand who he is.
Correct. There is a distinction that goes back to the Middle Ages and that was held to by Calvin and others, of course, that we've already touched on, and that is the distinction between who God is in himself, in the Latin, in se, and as he is toward us, which in the Latin is quoad nos. Don't you just love that? Quoad nos. Paul Helm has a really helpful chapter in a book called, if you're interested in learning about how Calvin handled this distinction.
What was that book called?
John Calvin's Ideas.
Okay, you dropped out just for a second there.
By Paul Helm, and it's published by Oxford University Press. About 2 or 3 years old now.
Okay.
And I think actually Scott Oliphant may refer to it in the Reasons for Faith volume.
He does several times. Yeah.
He references Helm.
He interacts with Paul Helm discussion on that and other matters. But yeah, it's helpful to remember that apart from God's condescension and revelation of himself, we are left to our own devices. What's interesting, at least to me, is that in the Middle Ages, they often talked as if there were no revelation. They because of the influence of Greek philosophical notions, and not all Greek philosophical notions are bad. So we want to be careful here. Through the influence of less than helpful notions, they talked about God being completely unknowable or indescribable,
mm-hmm.
and that's actually at the foundation of what we call mysticism, right? Is that God is not comprehensible. It's one thing to say that God is incomprehensible in the sense of we cannot know him exhaustively as he knows himself, but it's quite another thing to say that we cannot know him at all. And there's always a tendency to move in the direction of not being able to know God at all.
Well, isn't that typically the failure of a lot of theologies out there? Well, that's what they result in, the fact that we can't know God at all because he is transcendent. They entirely leave out the possibility that God would condescend to communicate with us.
Yeah, it's either the theologies out there go in either one of two directions. Either God becomes completely unknowable and you're left in with mysticism,
yeah.
Or God becomes completely comprehensible, graspable, and you end up in rationalism, where somehow, right. Some way you can grasp God. Yeah.
Now, isn't there a sense, Jim, in which Karl Barth's theology is actually an unstable combination of the two?
Yeah, that's right. It fluctuates, as it were, back and forth, and it falls into both pits, which is ironic.
Yeah, I think this is how it works with him. God is completely other, wholly other, totaliter aliter in the German, and therefore the Bible cannot be, strictly speaking, a revelation, but it let's call it revelation for argument's sake, and because God is totally other or wholly other, that revelation or that the Bible is a purely human document and therefore is subject to human rationality.
Yes,
that's right.
And that's where I'm referring to when we talk about the dialectic that's going on there. On the one hand, God is totally wholly other, and on the other hand, the Bible is purely human.
That's right. That's
so
right.
Because God Himself is not subject to human rationality, but the Bible is.
That's right. And if you take away direct revelation, and this is where Van Til was all over Bart, in taking away direct revelation, you leave the would-be autonomous man with his own devices. You leave him with having to somehow get to God by way of his own autonomous, whether it's reason or experience or whatever the case may be. And in that sense, really, Barton doesn't ever fully break with the rationalism of the Enlightenment and particularly Schleiermacher.
Right.
The only difference is that Schleiermacher leaned upon the subjective feelings.
Right.
For Barthes, it's more of a objective historical reconstruction by the autonomous man. Either way, you're left without a direct revelation.
And then which ultimately boils down to we're left to our own speculations.
That's right. Yeah.
Now it is true, of course, you know the expression finitum non capax infiniti. The finite cannot comprehend the infinite. And we want to affirm that because that's actually a biblical notion. The prophet Isaiah, right, speaks for God when God says, you know, my mind is higher than your mind, my thoughts are higher than your thoughts, and of course, God in the book of Isaiah clearly contrasts himself with the idols, which are dumb and stupid, right? I mean, they cannot talk and they cannot know the future. But anyway, so the finite cannot comprehend the infinite, but we can know, truly. And this is getting to what in later discussions in the post-Reformation Reformed era, beginning with a gentleman by the name of Franciscus Junius, in his volume on true theology, De Vera Theologia, he makes a distinction that's related to God in himself and God as he is toward us. And that distinction is the archetype-ectype distinction. God's knowledge of him perfect and exhaustive knowledge of himself and all that he has created. And then ectypal knowledge, which is God's revelation of himself and his will that human beings have.
Now, who's picked up on this distinction? Because we've heard from other people.
Well, yes. Well, the distinction becomes common property of the Protestant scholastics. But the one that you're probably referring to would be Cornelius Van Til. His doctrine of analogy, that man thinks God's thoughts after him, is basically, and it is not Thomas's doctrine. I want to get that out there clearly. Van Til's doctrine of analogy is not Thomas's doctrine. It is but a reformulation of the archetype-ectype distinction that was common property of the post-Reformation Reformed theologians. Although that is disputed by some folk.
Yeah, can we find that in Muller's volume that had been mentioned?
Oh, yeah, in the first volume especially, which deals with prolegomena, you'll find a lengthy discussion of the archetype-ectype distinction.
Excellent.
Van Til's reference, now because Van Til does not use the archetype-ectype language frequently,
okay,
but there is a reference to it in Introduction to Systematic Theology. I believe in the old edition, I have not looked in the new edition, or I haven't memorized the page pagination. In the old edition, it was on, I think, on page 203. There was a direct reference, in case someone doubts this, there was, and there is, a direct correlation between the archetype-ectype distinction and Van Til's doctrine of analogy. Now, because of the confusion that has arisen, we think especially, we recall especially the Clark-Van Til controversy, right?
Right.
Over Van Til's doctrine of analogy and the doctrine of incomprehensibility of God, where Clark confuses Van Til's doctrine for Thomas Aquinas' doctrine of analogy. We asked the question, why does Van Til use the term analogy with its historically loaded connotations when he could have simply said archetype-ectype, defined it as it was used in the Reformed tradition, and perhaps not had the confusion? Well, I think it's because Hermann Bavinck, and I believe Abraham Kuyper also, used the term analogy with regard to the archetype-ectype distinction. So once again, Van Til is, in this regard, building on the work of Hermann Bavinck's Reformed Dogmatics. And again, I think that's Volume 1 of the Reformed Dogmatics, where you'll find the talk about the archetype-ectype distinction and man being an analog of God.
What other types of distinctions have we found in systematic theology regarding these attributes?
Well, before we get to that, there's probably one more idea to stress before we talk about the attributes as such, and that is how do we know them, or how do we know about God? There have been historically three ways of getting at the attributes of God. The via causalitatis, you like that? The way of causation or causality. The via negationis, which is the way of negation.
So that's more like apophatic theology.
Yes, that's correct.
Right, that's
and
correct.
Then the via eminentiae, the way of eminence or the way of heightening. Those are three typical ways of getting at the attributes of God. The way of causality, of course, is arguing from the effect to a cause. The way of negation, of course, is to think about all of what a human being is and removing the imperfection. Hmm. And then the third, the way of eminence, is to take all the good qualities of creation or of human creation and raising them to their absolute height.
Right.
Those are interesting, and there may be some value in them. However, we prefer, and I think that the Reformed tradition prefers, to go with Scripture. What has God revealed of Himself? Correct?
Right.
So rather than beginning then with a bare or brute natural theology, or at least one which is apart from revelation, we actually begin with God's word revelation, or His special revelation, as it's been given to us within the Holy Scriptures, oftentimes in propositional terms.
Right. So the problem with those three ways are that they are a natural theology. And they start from the ground and try to work their way up. And we would say, no, it's actually the other way around. It starts from above, from God, who reveals Himself to us. Now, in terms of the attributes of God, the term itself, attribute, can be somewhat misleading as Louis Burkhoff points out in his systematic theology, because the term itself seems to suggest something added on to the being of God.
That's where we wanted to go in terms of who God is. He's fundamentally different than we are, being that He is simple. He has simplicity, and He's independent. He's an absolute being. So attributes relate to Him completely different than they relate to us.
Right, we have to keep that, because the very term we use, from the Latin, suggests additions. And of course, when you start, when you say addition, the implication is subtraction, right?
Yes.
And God in himself, in his very own being or nature, we affirm a simple being. And when we get to the incommunicable attributes in the next episode, we can clarify what we mean by that. That's one of those doctrines that is attacked frequently, specifically within the Christian tradition of analytic philosophy.
And Ronald Nash has a wonderful quotation that the doctrine of simplicity has a public relations problem.
Yes. even someone as thoughtful as Alvin Plantinga has attacked the doctrine.
He's essentially eschewed it.
Yes, in his lecture, Does God Have a Nature?
Hmm.
I think there's problems with that, and it's also related to the issue of the doctrine of the Trinity. Those who tend toward a social doctrine of the Trinity, a social model, tend to reject simplicity. And that's almost an episode in its own right, because what are the implications of rejecting simplicity, well, among other things, and then we'll move back to what we were talking about.
But at root here is that God is identical with his properties or attributes.
If we deny something like simplicity, I think we have to go down the road of denying God's omniscience, among other things. I mean,
and his self-contained aseity as well.
Right, aseity goes out the window. Eternality. So these, and that's actually getting at one of the points we want to make. Is that the attributes and God's being are co-inherent, right?
Yeah.
They don't they're not parts that can be added or subtracted.
It's almost this Plantinga, what he falls into is sort of a Platonism in which there are these forms, this store of attributes somewhere. Mm. So it's not as though love exists apart from the being of God. It's that God is love, and that's an identification. It's not that he takes love from this pool of properties and adds it to himself. It's that he is identical to love, among other things.
And that's where the term attributes can sometimes become, you know, confusing. And so we have to qualify exactly what we mean by the term. I mean, we have to qualify and explain what we mean by all the terms we use. I mean, we talked about the terminology of analogy. It's a loaded term, but it's a helpful term when properly and biblically defined. So,
right, that's what you need to get at, is we always need to define our term. Now, probably because I think we're running low on time here, I just wanted to quote from Dr. Burkhoff when he's coming to the end of his general or generic discussion of God's being and attributes. He tells us the only proper way to obtain perfectly reliable knowledge of the divine attributes is by the study of God's self-revelation in Scripture.
That's where it is. Where you have to go.
Yeah, that's on page 54 of the what is called the New Combined Edition. And then there's another quote in the same paragraph. Man does not elicit knowledge from God as he does from other objects of study, but God conveys knowledge of himself to man, a knowledge which man can only accept and appropriate.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
In other words, it's given to us, and we either accept or reject it to our peril. Right,
and that way we understand. Maybe this brings things down the brass tacks here, but we understand that the knowledge of God, our knowing God, I should rather say, is covenantal at its heart. It is a relationship, really, that God establishes with man. It comes by way of covenant, in which God comes to us to open and to reveal himself to us graciously, kindly, and in a way that we can understand him, and we are brought before the face of God morally responsible to respond to that revelation in the way in which it has been given to us. Otherwise, we're either, as Van Til was fond of saying, there are either covenant keepers or covenant breakers.
Right.
And right. Those who respond in non-acceptance, in rejection of that revelation are the covenant breakers. Covenant keepers are the ones who respond in faith and acceptance of God's self-revelation. And of course, we know that because of the fall, how that whole thing went.
It's impossible not to be in a relationship with God, and it's either good or bad.
That's right. That's right.
Right.
Well, we have to say goodbye to this very abbreviated episode, but we'll be back next week discussing this topic again. We're going to delve into God's attributes to start maybe listing them or discussing more of the incommunicable and communicable attributes, but we wanted to lay a brief foundation this week. But until then, you can visit castlechurch.org. You can read our show notes. You can also get our bibliography. I tried to make those a little easier to read now, so if you just click on our episode title, you'll see the full list of books that we mention. But you can also find more information about our other programs. You can subscribe also to our feeds in order to get this show and others downloaded to your computer. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can visit castlechurch.org/contact to send us your questions or comments, but you can also email us at christthecenter@castlechurch.org, or even you can call us at 215-392-0946 and leave a voicemail. But for everyone here at Castle Church, we thank you for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.